So yeah, so I was kind of interested to think about the topic of greed. I don't often talk about that. My mind immediately goes to the rather consumerist culture that we live in. So it's quite nice to have an opportunity to just sort of muse around that. And I was doing some preparation yesterday, so I watched The Wolf of Wall Street. I don't know if any of you, maybe you've seen that film. Yeah, a few nods. So I only managed to get, it's a 3-hour film, so it's you know, it's quite substantial. I only managed to get about halfway through it so far, but I did feel quite sort of interested in it. And for those of you that haven't watched it, so it's a story about a young man who sort of gets, in a way, enticed and inspired by the stock market and the sort of world that the stock market and the market, if you like, creates. So he gets very absorbed very quickly in this high adrenaline, high-paced, competitive, quite sort of macho environment. And yeah, it's quite interesting to see. He's sort of, you know, he's quite young and he's just naturally very drawn to it. And he's very, very good at it. So quite quickly he starts his own business. And then there's this sort of scene about midway through where, so his father works for him, and he's talking with his father, and his father's trying to clear up the sort of mess that he's making, because he's doing some quite like criminal things now. Things have gone a bit far-fetched. In a way, like, his money can buy anything that he wants. So there's a lot of buying of drugs, there's a lot of prostitution, and it's very much sort of like this gets into the seedier side of this environment that's around him and that he helps create. And there's just this one quite poignant scene where he's chatting with his father, and his father says something like, oh, it's just totally over the top. You know, he's trying to sort of say to him, you've gone too far now. He's trying to, in a way, allude to you might get prosecuted. And he turns to his father and he just sort of says, yeah, it's obscene. He says something like, it's obscene. So what I'm doing is just obscene. And it's sort of like a bit of a moment of clarity in the film where he just sort of describes what he's doing with something that sort of really sort of cuts into the heart of this kind of environment. And then he sort of carries on doing it. So it's like in a way it's very compulsive and addictive, what he's sort of involved in and around. So I was thinking, you know, we might not work in the city, we might not all be stockbrokers, but we probably have a sort of taste of what our sort of more compulsive kind of habits, where they can kind of lead us. So we probably all have had a taste of doing too much X, Y and Z, whatever it is. Might be eating too much, might be drinking too much. Might be like acquiring too much to the point where something feels uncomfortable. So we do have this sort of greedy kind of appetite, if you like, for kind of acquisition, for sort of having things. So that's kind of like, in a way, that's quite natural. So it's not particularly a big sort of moral issue. So we do have that kind of movement in us, those habits, those tendencies. So we do have needs and wants. So it's not like a big moral issue about that being wrong. It's just that in certain conditions, in certain ways and modes of being, it can go quite extreme and it can get quite over the top. So I was thinking a little bit about that and how, in a way, this movement in the mind to want to have things is not necessarily always problematic, but what happens when it is, when it starts to become more problematic. So I was going to talk a little bit about what happens to us as individuals around our relationship with greed, or wanting more, maybe wanting more than we need to have. And then I'll talk more sort of collectively, like what happens when groups of people want more. So what happens when, in a way, we look more collectively and across sort of societies and nations if we do that. So much sort of bigger perspective too. So we are kind of involved in a system of capitalism, which is in a way like a structure that we're all involved in. And we do have these sort of needs and wants, don't we? So we need food to live. We need water. We need shelter. We need some sort of a kind of creative outlet. We need to express ourselves. We need leisure time. Yeah, we need to involve ourselves in leisure, if you like. But we also want to be happy. So it's quite difficult to sort of consume happiness. But we're... hello there, do come in. But we're kind of told that if we consume more, we'll be happier. And while Buddhism and meditation basically says that that's a delusion. So the main message often from our more consumerist, more materialistic values that we're touched by and live around is that if we consume more, we'll be happier. And while the Buddha said it's not true, it's a delusion. So it's... In out. It's, if you like, that's like a spell that we're captivated and captured by, but it doesn't provide real happiness. It doesn't provide what it sort of says on the tin. So this idea that if we consume more, we'll be happier. I'll argue that if we consume less, we'll be happier. But it's not quite that simple either. It's more like if we change our relationship to what we have, what we actually have, what's around us, the resources around us, if we change our relationship with that, then we will be happier. So not only will we be happier if we have less, but if we change our perspective on what we actually have, we'll feel richer. So that in a way is what Buddhism and the Buddha kind of has to offer us. It's like a change of perspective. And with that change of perspective comes a responsibility. So it doesn't just mean that we will individually be happier. It means that we'll want to talk about that more. It means that we'll want to influence others. It means that we'll want others to have a taste of a different perspective. So it doesn't stop just with us. It brings with it quite a responsibility to engage with others. So I grew up in quite a materialist age. I was grew up in the 80s, really, and Margaret Thatcher was the Prime Minister, and I very much sort of learnt and was conditioned by the idea that happiness was all about acquiring certain things. So things like getting a good job, a house, a car, having holidays, having savings, and so on and so on. So I've been sort of conditioned by that attitude, if you like. My mind has been patterned by it. And then at a certain point in my mid-20s, I thought, well, I have some of those things. I have some of those things. But I felt that there was more. So I felt a bit like I'd stepped out of the delusion slightly and thought, oh, I think it is a delusion. Because do you know what? I'm always chasing a better job. I'm always thinking, oh, if only I had a little bit more money, if only I got a promotion, if only my relationship was a little bit better than this one, if only, yeah, I was kind of like living in this futuristic more, you know, if I could just get a little bit more, then, you know, if I could go not to Europe on my holidays, but to the States, I'd be happier. So I was sort of somewhat bought into it, but I felt like existentially that there was something a bit different, that maybe there was another way to happiness that I didn't necessarily start. I started to not believe in the delusion as much as I had done. And while I imagine, you know, that many of you have got a taste of that, you wouldn't be here really if you hadn't. So you've got some sense that maybe, at times we live slightly captured by this spell or delusion that we're going to be happier if we have more. So maybe you come here and you think, oh, okay, so what are we selling? what's what could be this different perspective? So what I kind of learnt when I came here was I learnt to meditate, and that had quite a strong effect on my mind and the way that I saw this kind of delusion, if you like, of more and more can make me happier and happier. Because one of the main things I learnt was, well, besides the fact that my ankles hurt a lot when I first started to meditate, it seems like hours after hours of my body hurting. So I learnt that, learnt a bit more about my body. But slowly over time, when I learnt to sit slightly higher in meditation, my ankles stop hurting as much. I learnt that happiness is not, it's not circumstantial. So my circumstances hadn't changed when I came here. I still had a fairly good job. I had a relationship that was a bit rocky, and I had a whole bunch of other stuff going on that I became a bit more aware of when I meditated. But I wasn't necessarily happier. But at times during the meditation, it was like there was happiness. There was a certain sort of quality of kind of relaxation and absorption, and I felt more together, I felt a bit more integrated, and at those times I felt happy. And then at other times in my life I wouldn't feel so happy. So I learnt that kind of coming to meditate, I could experience these little moments where I was completely contented and completely happy, and it had nothing to do with how much I had, how much I owned, whether I had a good job, whether I had a partner. It was like in these brief moments, there was just a lot of contentment. So that was quite revelatory to me. It was quite sort of confusing in a way, because it wasn't anything that, in a way, I had thought of before. It was like a change of perspective. It was like stepping into a different kind of place, a different zone. So in a way, awareness was starting to dawn that maybe the messages that I'd learned and grown up around weren't quite true, that there was something else. Something else could lead to happiness and to more fulfilment. So often what we introduce here is that we have to work on our own individual minds. So we have to become more aware of what drives us, what motivates us, whether it's possible to experience happiness in these moments. And as we experience more and more of our minds, we become more aware of what drives us. So often we're driven by pushing things away that we don't want, and by trying to grasp after things that we do want. But as you sort of go through that process of examining and working with your mind, you start to see through it a bit more. You start to see that maybe what you do want, what you're trying to grasp after, isn't quite graspable after all. And what you want to push away, sometimes it's not a good idea to. So I'm talking much more on a sort of emotional level, in a way. When you start to meditate, when you start to get a sense of working with your mind, you just realise that there are these quite strong currents in our mind, that we really push away things we don't want, whether it's ankle pain or an idea of ourselves, or maybe we've had a row with somebody. We often try to push away the experience. Or if things are going well for us, or we have things, often we're not satisfied, we want more. Maybe we experience relaxation in meditation, and we want it, and in grasping after it, we tighten up, and it eludes us. So we start to become a bit more aware of how our mind actually works. So it's a more subtle sort of level of understanding or awareness of our mind, and then it affects everything else in our life. So as soon as you start meditating and bringing other people in to the meditation, you immediately start to change your relationship with them. So maybe you start to understand other people a bit more, why they push things away or try to pull things towards them, and then you start to have a bit more empathy for us doing that, and you feel a bit more interconnected, a bit more closer to people, a bit more friendly perhaps, just a little bit looser in your habits. And before you know it, you'll realise that you can change. So you can change by working with your mind. And so that starts to become a bit more fulfilling, if you like. it's a bit more, you can place your hand upon it a bit more, you can trust it a bit more. So it doesn't mean that you'll always be happy, but you can deal with when you're not happy in a more sort of resourced way, if you like. So that becomes a bit more satisfying, rather than just pushing away when you experience sadness, or maybe you feel angry or whatever. So I was rather tickled by, I was reading a little bit about, you know, because shopping and getting things, it does have an effect on our mind, doesn't it? So it is like, it can often be quite pleasurable. Yeah, I mean, some people say, don't they, oh, I don't like shopping. It's really stressful, it's a few knots, yeah. But for brief moments, it can feel quite, what's the word? Like, you can feel quite strong, can't you, somehow? You can feel in control, yeah? You can feel like, ah, I've got what I want. You can feel temporarily satisfied. It often doesn't last that long, but for those moments, you do feel different, you feel better. So I'm not advocating that we don't shop ever again. Yeah, we can't. We can't avoid it in the system that we're in. But I was very, very tickled by this quote from a woman who's done in the 70s did some work on advertising and looking at advertising. It's called Decoding Advertising, her book. She's called Judith Williamson, and she says shopping gives you a sense of choice and power, which is often absent from the rest of your life. Which I found very interesting as a sort of concept. In a way, she looked at advertising per se, and advertising sells power and sexiness and control and health often, and all of these sort of positive things that we want. But often when we shop, we do actually step into that world, if you like. You could call it a delusion. Certainly an advert is usually a delusion. It's based on very little. But it conjures up something. But what it does is it draws in what we're already thinking. So we're thinking, I want to be powerful and confident and strong and sexy and good looking and thin and all these other things that the adverts kind of press upon. So we do have those kind of mechanisms in our mind. We do often have those beliefs that it's often shaped by the culture we're in. You know, we want these things. And just temporarily in the moment, it can feel often like we've got them. Yeah, our latest iPhone says that we're sexy, doesn't it? It's like it says we're powerful. Yeah, there's like a feel-good sort of factor. So you have to somehow plunge into the moment of shopping and acknowledge that, and then maybe question it a bit more. So you have to kind of like see a bit more in it. So our temporary happiness is just part of what's happening. So I was thinking, I've got this sort of advert that I sort of loathe, and I see it around the place because it's on the back of vans, and it's a supermarket advert, and it has a picture of strawberries, and it says freshly clicked. For some reason, I sort of love to loathe this advert. And I think by the reason why I sort of loathe it is because, in a way, it's like a pun, isn't it? It's like an association with picked. Yeah. So you would pick a strawberry. But no, you're sort of clicking them. So you're online, aren't you, doing your online internet shopping, which I confess I do. And so it says freshly clicked, and I think there's nothing fresh about this strawberry. Because often, like, if you were to more imagine what had happened with this particular strawberry, you'd see that it's not just like waiting for you in the ground and that somebody kind of picks it and then it arrives at your doorstep. You probably see that it's been picked probably very far away, somewhere very far away. And then it's been stored in a big warehouse often, chilled in really good conditions, so that your strawberry can basically be fresher. And then it's been packaged up, and it's often been driven quite a long way, often by a big lorry that's emitting quite a lot of kind of fumes. And And then, you know, then it arrives, doesn't it, somewhere else. And then it gets put into a little van that says freshly clicked on it. And then it kind of arrives with you. So our sort of moments of kind of happiness when we get our strawberry, I'm not suggesting that in a way there's anything unnatural with that. That is our experience often, isn't it? Ah, oh, great, strawberries on my porridge in the morning. But if we stop to imagine what's actually happened in the process of getting the strawberry to us, we might just find that the world's slightly more complex than freshly clicked. Yeah, there are certain things that have happened that maybe if we knew that up front and that was on the back of the van, we might think a little bit more about where we get the strawberry from. We might make different choices. We might think, oh, actually, I don't want it to be in a big sort of warehouse somewhere being chilled. I don't want to contribute to that. So it's worthwhile thinking, you know, about what happens to us when we do consume and about the sort of positive emotions we often feel. And then it's worth just thinking about the backstory a bit more, which I'm sure many of you do these days. So I wanted to just talk a little bit away from the individual and a bit more about the collective, and then I'll stop and we can have more of a chat. So if you like, the sort of promise of capitalism is that if we sell more and corporations get richer and richer, then there'll be more to go around. That's a very sort of basic premise of capitalism, that, you know, in a way, like the free market will provide more in a competitive mode, but the rich will get richer, but that will also mean that the economy kind of is bigger, which will mean that there's more to go around. So in a sense, there's like nothing particularly wrong with capitalism. It's just a system. But you have to think about whether at the sort of extremes of the system, whether there is more to go around. So often more capitalist economists really sort of you know, warn against the sort of edges of the system, if you like, that left unchecked and unregulated, capitalism can cause more suffering, particularly to certain people, than if it's just left kind of in a way deregulated. So we have a mixture, don't we, in this country, of some public goods, some private goods, some not-for-profit situations. We have regulation, but it's worthwhile thinking if we have enough. Yeah, it's worthwhile thinking if we have enough. So there was this great report in the newspaper this week about the richest 1% in the world owning more than 50% of the population have. So the poorest 50% of people in the world own collectively the same as the richest 1%. So that, in a way, would be a sort of example of the inequality of this particular model, if you like, this kind of mode. And I was wondering what the Buddha might say about that. So, you know, what does the Buddha, do you think he's a free market kind of proponent or not? And in a way, I have no idea what the Buddha would say. Yeah. I just have to sort of imagine, in a way. So, yeah, the Buddha mainly taught that we suffer, that we do, not only do we suffer, but that we create our own suffering, and that there is a way out. So the Buddha's very, very interested in suffering. So if people suffer under a system, he'd be interested. Yeah, he'd think, oh, what could we do about that? So I was wondering what he might say about the refugee crisis, or what he might say about workers that are exploited, or what he might say about all sorts of situations in the world. So one thing he wouldn't say is, oh, sit on your meditation cushion and experience happiness in the moment and be content at that. So he is interested in teaching us about how to work with our minds. He's also interested in teaching us about how to be responsible when we maybe have a bit more sensitivity, a bit more awareness. So how we act in the world is really, really important. when it comes to what the Buddha teaches. And the Buddha's very interested in conditions, so the conditions which allow us to change our mind and to act more freely and creatively are really, really important. So he probably would be interested in regulation. He probably would be interested in the 50% that have very little, say. So he would be interested in our basic needs about food and clothing and shelter. But he'd probably say you could have a bit less, but feel like you were a bit richer inside. So if you had a different relationship with what you have, if you really understood this sort of principle of interconnectedness. In a way, if you understood a bit more about where your strawberries come from, you could act a bit more creatively. So rather than just passively consuming, you could start to think, oh, okay, yeah, well, maybe I could do something, maybe I could make different choices. So one of the things that I wanted to bring in, and then I'll just wrap up, is this idea about consuming less. So it seems like it is going to be unsustainable for us to keep consuming at the rate that we're consuming. Not only our sort of human resources that are getting kind of exploited, but also our environmental resources. It seems like very soon that the kind of, in a way, this consume more, be happier value-driven system is going to sort of cause us real problems. And of course, it's already causing lots of communities problems already over the world. So if for the environmental impact alone, we need to think about consuming a bit less. So I wanted to just tell you about a book that's really great on this topic. So it's a book by David Loy, who's an American Buddhist. It's called Money, Sex, War and Karma. And David Loy cites three problems that he thinks we ought to educate ourselves and be more aware about. So collectively, he's suggesting that sort of institutionally, there are sort of systemic problems. So he suggests that our economic system is driven by greed. So in a way, all the messages are more, more, more. That's the direction it goes in. And he suggests that our militarism, our, if you like, the money that we put into and the resources we put into the military and militarization and arms, well, that institutionalizes hatred. And then he suggests that our corporate media institutionalizes or creates this pattern of delusion. So often the media oversimplifies things. It presents things in a very black and white way. And that's the core delusion. If you see beyond it, you see that things are much more complex. Things are very rarely right or wrong or black and white in that way. So this idea that corporations or organisations are never profitable enough, that they've always got to be on the move, growing larger and larger, and that we will never consume enough, it can seem really relentless. But it is a delusion. It's like our collective delusion that that might be the right way, if you like. And that our collective delusion is that there's no alternative to it, that consuming a little bit less or being a little bit smaller as an institution might actually bring benefits. So he's quite strong, isn't he? Institutional greed, hatred and delusion. If you like, these are the three poisons that the Buddha talked about, the things that drive us. Yeah, greed, hatred and delusion. They're often behind our actions. But we can turn them around. Yeah, we can work with our relationship with them. And we can turn greed into generosity. We can turn hatred into love, and we can turn delusion into wisdom. But that is our sort of working ground. Yeah, we all have these forces within us, and we can work on them, and not only at an individual level, but a collective level and an institutional level. So I'll just sum up and just say some things about what we might do, some ideas. So the first thing we need to do is work on ourselves, so work on our minds so that we become more ethically sensitive, ethically aware, more aware of what drives us, our habits, our patterns, our tendencies, more aware that happiness is not sort of conditional on having more. Yeah, we can experience these moments of happiness that's much, much more about contentment and fulfillment rather than having things. And if you're interested in Buddhism or mindfulness, then in a way you can start to really get a better relationship with generosity and kindness, just sort of start to exemplify that more. And then we can act collectively, so we can live together. We don't need to live in separate kind of two people pods or anything. We can start to pool our resources and live more collectively. Often you make great savings when you do that, both environmentally and financially. We can shop together, either in co-ops or together, using our resources together. We can create community. We can look after collective spaces together. We can think about things like libraries and leisure facilities and see if we can put energy into conserving more of a collective endeavour. And we can put not only our time and energy into that, but we can put our financial resources. So if we have financial resources, we can put that in too. But it's not quite enough. So one of the things we need to do is educate ourselves, often about economics. We can think it's terribly confusing or a bit inaccessible. Actually, once you scratch below the surface, it's quite easy to educate yourself about economics. And that will mean that you'll have better influence around your leaders, say your chief exec of your organisation you might work for. You could influence them, your politicians, our media. If we're better educated about economics, then often we'll stand a better chance of creating a better argument. We might want to contribute to things like if the hospital's closing, maybe we want to campaign around that. Maybe we want to get involved in environmental issues. And maybe a good thing to do is when you are meditating, if you are a meditator, bring to mind the world's problems. So keep it imaginatively alive in your imagination. Keep connecting with others, because it's much more likely that you'll act when you're off the cushion if you do that. So keep a breadth of perspective rather than thinking about yourself and your issues and problems. Think broadly, think globally. We can think about buying fair trade, we can think about being a vegetarian, we can think about being a vegan, we can encourage sharing. So all these little acts can add up to a lot, especially when we act collectively. And then within this community here, we've got a lot to do too. So one of the things we can exemplify is generosity. So, you know, hopefully you're enjoying a free day today of lots of good activities. We can practice friendship and community to keep it much more alive imaginatively. Then we can start to explore alternative approaches to business, to working together. And ultimately a centre like this can provide a space for relaxation or calmness, which is so needed, isn't it, in our busy, busy lives and in the culture in which we live in. So I'm just going to end with a little quote from, there's a book called The Buddha on Wall Street by an order member called Vardika. And just going to end with the final paragraph from his book, which is quite striking, quite beautifully written. And then we'll pause, and we've got about 10 minutes for questions. So he says, the basic instincts for individual survival, greed and hatred, once served us well in a primitive, competitive world. But now in our interdependent world, where our actions threaten our very survival, the progressive evolutionary impulses of giving, caring and compassion need to flourish. The Buddha showed us that evolution can lead to a life free of suffering and full of liberation and creativity. But if they continue to get their way, the proponents of free market economics and neoliberal capitalism will suffocate the process of evolution. Which is it to be? A life of enlightenment or a life of shopping? Okay. So we've got about 10 minutes. If anybody wants to ask anything, maybe you want to just share any comments. Yeah.
How does one feel the emotion of greed? Like, how can you be mindful about it in a way that you can, you know, change it? So, for example, I'm being very greedy by watching too much Netflix in a way, because I'm thinking, oh, well, you know, I'm paying whatever, £10 a month.
Yeah.
I might as well watch 100 movies instead of 10.
Yeah.
Well,
I suppose I wonder if one of the things the Buddha would probably say is that a very easy way to kind of notice what's happening more when you... Well, you don't even click for the next episode on Netflix, do you? Often it just appears. It's like in 9, 8, 7, 6 seconds. It just kind of feeds you it. So one thing you can do is, you could sit in that sort of gap watching the countdown and starting to think about how it affects your mind. So I did notice myself, I was watching The Wolf of Wall Street on Netflix yesterday. And I thought, oh, if I watch too much more of this, I won't be in a very good mental state to give a talk today. Because it has quite a strong effect on your mind. So whatever you're watching on Netflix, if you're watching it in a kind of compulsive way, one thing is you need to notice what you're watching and see if it's conducive to a more relaxed, contented mind. And, you know, it might not be. But 'cause a lot of us use... kind of things like Netflix, don't we, just kind of like relax and kind of switch off. And in a certain way, there's probably not much wrong with that. It's just that when you're on to your 9th episode and 10th episode of an evening, it's like you're watching compulsively. It's like you really got no awareness of what you're doing. You're just sort of hooked into it. So then you're grooving a habit of sort of unawareness, if you like. So the first thing to notice is that you're doing that and see if you can sort of step out of it. To see, maybe you could just like watch one or two things and then do something else. So, you know, for most of us, we can't even have a minute where we're not doing anything. So one of the first things we often suggest at the Buddhist Centre is just to try and have idle time. Try even a minute of doing nothing. No phone, nothing to swipe through, nothing to read, just sitting and, you know, maybe have a cup of tea. And see if a minute could turn into 5 minutes, and you soon notice the your mind much more when you do that, you know, without stimulation, and usually you feel much more contented if you can sit with it a bit longer than this sort of, it's this unease, isn't it, that makes us almost stuff our time with things to do or, you know, the things we consume. So yeah, those are some of my thoughts about the Netflix kind of consumption, if you like.
Yeah. I think I've listened to what you said and it's quite very interesting. But then I also want to ask a question to look at your perspective. Now, how much of greed is sort of, I mean, you did mention things like shopping and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the way I look at it is, those kind of stuff, are they driven by the size of our wallet, or the fact that we just don't have control over what do we call it, our inner greed. So in terms of how we balance with our, because there can be elements of greed which can be good, can drift to technology and other stuff coming out of that, and then there can be bad aspect of it as well, and that starts to happen. It's upon us to find a way that we can balance it so that we know that as an individual, my drive to get more, how does it affect the person next to me? How does that impoverish the person next to me?
Sounds a bit like there's sort of two things going on there. So to take the last one, it's a bit like, it'd be great, wouldn't it, if all of us had a bit more of an imagination around how our buying and consuming and shopping does affect things, and just so that we could maybe make choices that we feel more behind. So when we're a bit more aware and educated, we do make slightly different choices. And then there's this kind of how big is your wallet kind of phenomenon. And in a certain way, we are encaptured or enthralled to the spell that we need X amount, aren't we? And X amount that we think we need is always slightly larger than what we have. So no matter how much you have, you do seem to believe that and think that. She's slightly like getting lost in the delusion of it. So I remember sort of many, many years ago, I took a job in the Buddhist movement. And one of the things we practice is living a very simple life and a very simple living on not a wage, but like it's called a support package. And so I probably took a cut in wages of like, I don't know, two thirds or a lot anyway. And I partly thought I'm crazy doing that. Like, why on earth would I give up my job where I have a bigger wallet for a job with a smaller wallet? And I was a bit worried that I wouldn't be able to live on the amount. And I soon changed some of my habits in a way, changed the way I worked, but I also changed what I spent money on and how I spent money. And in general, I consumed less. So on a certain level, the more we have, the more we can obviously consume. So we do need to sort of step out of the almost like the paradigm that says it's good to have more and more, you know, however much we have. I mean, some of us, maybe we don't have enough. You know, we have a habit of not providing enough for ourselves. So I'm not really addressing that. You know, if that's our habit, we need to learn to be a bit more generous with ourselves. You know, we do need to look after ourselves. But for most of us, we have more than enough than what we need. It's just sort of trying to change our relationship with it as well, and to see it for what it is. Maybe to be grateful for what we have, rather than always looking about how to get more. So there's sort of various shifts in attitude we can make. But often, like for me, it was almost like an imposed attitude shift of like, oh, if what would happen if I did step out of this wanting more and more, would I change? Would my habits change? And they did quite strongly. So it was like a sort of stepping out of the system, I suppose, which does have a big effect. You know, can be much more creative. Good points. Yep.
Let's say to enjoy life, you need time to do the things you want to do. To have time, you need to have enough money not to work all the time.
Yeah, you do. Yeah.
If you want to have enough money, you've got to be greedy and become rich. If you don't do that, you're going to have to work most of your life. And so that's a paradox. I mean, what's the way out? If you want to have time to do things you love, you've got to be greedy and get money. So you don't have to work all day. But if you do work all day and you suffer, you don't like, you can't find a job that you like because you want to do something else. I don't know, create art, for example. What are you going to do? I mean, how can you say, I'm happy with what I have, which is working most of the day doing something I don't like?
I mean, it's become a real question, hasn't it, for us? Because in a way we are starting to question whether we do want more and more and more and want to work more and more and more and have more of our time in that. So I think it has become like almost like the next question is like, how can I earn enough to take care of my needs, but also have this much more time to do maybe other things that we want to do, our art practice or, you know, other things that we could think of. So that does require us shifting perspective, and it does require us realising that we can't have everything. So often we can't put lots of energy into making lots of money and spending lots of energy and time on that and have space and time for other things. They're like two different energetic modes often. So we need somehow to make sure that our energy that wants to earn and provide for ourselves can be met, but also keep trying to create time and space. And that, well, I think, will involve us earning less. I think it's very, very difficult to energetically put time and money into earning more and more and more and doing less, if you like. So it is a paradox, but it's a paradox. It's a really good question because it's something that we're all very interested in, you know, because in a way we have kind of seen through the delusion of that more and more and more will make us happier and happier. We've sort of start to value things a bit differently, you know, this time that we want for other things. So it's a very, very sort of topical question. Yeah, I'm afraid we're about out of time. So So thank you for your observations and questions. Very enjoyable. And wish you well. Hopefully see you again here soon. Thank you.